BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Good evening and welcome to the 6th of January Dialect Holiday Special. I'm Jeff Sparks and I'll be bringing you a selection of longer interviews with people we very rarely hear from on the radio or on television. Why? Because they're controversial. This week we have Daniel Mashover and also Yasmin Alibi Brown. First up we have a track by Angry Panda and this is a track titled Rockets. Angry Panda with Rockets. The situation in Palestine this winter is horrendous for those Palestinians under siege imposed by the Israeli Defence Force. Rather than a word from the Bible, a symbolic of hope for the future, many argue that Israel has become a byword for human rights abuses, oppression and apartheid. And Great Britain bears a lot of the responsibility for the situation, having handed the land over to the present Israeli state in 1947. Anyway, a new network was created recently in London of Jewish people in solidarity with the plight of the Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza. It's called the International Jewish Solidarity Network. As a part of their launch in the autumn, Jewish human rights lawyer Daniel Mashover explains what his firm of lawyers has been doing from their London offices to support Palestinians.
I'm going to go into the cases that we presented to a court in London in September 2005. And then I'm going to explain what happened with that case. That's what I'm going to talk about. My firm of solicitors for many years has had a commitment to working on human rights issues all around the criminal justice system, and that's to do with victims of abuse inside the prisons in this country, victims of miscarriages of justice, victims of police misconduct. We also have acted and continue to act for people who feel that as victims of crime in this country, they've not received justice. As part of an extension of that work, we got involved in looking at the failure to bring to get justice for victims of international crimes, where there's a possible remedy in the UK. And there's a possible remedy in the UK under something called the principle of universal jurisdiction. And people will know about the Pinochet case, because that's obviously a very famous example of the exercise of universal jurisdiction. So the crime of torture, whether it's committed in times of war or in times of peace, and in whatever country on the planet, has given rise to a right of universal jurisdiction. If a suspected torturer is living in this country, is visiting this country, there's a duty on the state to, if they know about that person and the evidence against them, to arrest them and bring them to trial in this country. That's an example. And then we have another raft of examples to do with war crimes. And obviously, with my own background and my interest in Israel and the occupied territories, it was a natural route to look at possible cases that could be brought against Israelis either living here, studying here, or visiting the UK, against whom there was evidence that they'd been involved in war crimes. So we started working really at the end of 2004, early 2005, with the Palestinian Centre for Human Rights in the Gaza Strip and with human rights organisations, Israeli and Palestinian, in the West Bank. And my colleague and I from the firm went to visit victims and their lawyers and collected evidence. And our strategy really was to bring these cases to the British police. There's a specialist unit within the Metropolitan Police Force called the War Crimes Unit. Unfortunately, it's mixed in with the anti-terrorist unit. And you can tell that given that we ended up presenting these cases to that unit in July 2005, the kind of reception we received from the anti-terrorist unit. But I'll come to that in a minute. And there's a systemic problem there with not giving enough resources to these cases, given that the number of suspects there are on the loose. So we went and we collected evidence, and our strategy was to present that evidence, as I said, to this unit and to try and bring cases in the UK where we found people that were visiting. We had no idea at that stage that Doron Almig was planning a visit that summer. That was long before he was in our sights specifically. We had a number of cases. We won't publicise which those cases are because we want to keep everyone guessing. But I can tell you that we've presented, and the Metropolitan Police know about many cases. We've got a long list of suspects with them. I want to first of all explain that it wouldn't have been possible for us to even start this work without the very brave work of human rights caseworkers, human rights defenders in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. They go to great risks to collect this evidence firsthand, to visit witnesses, to collect photographic evidence, to take the kind of evidence that would be acceptable to meet the criminal standard in a court abroad. And their purpose originally, of course, was to try and get justice locally. And they presented all the cases that we presented to the police have been presented to the Israeli authorities for justice for the victims locally. And in each case, either because it's a systemic issue and they're actually behind the war crimes from the top, or because they won't deal with the individuals where they step out of line, there's been no justice for the victims. And I'll explain the four cases that we've made public because we presented them to the court in September 2005. Those were the demolition of 59 houses in the Rafah district of the Gaza Strip on the 10th of January 2002. It's a war crime to extensively destroy property where that's not justified by military necessity. And those houses were not a justified destruction. Then we brought a case of a killing of a pregnant woman who was in the house next door to a house that was targeted for demolition because of the family being implicated in terrorist activities. The reason we brought that case was because the Israeli authorities have been told time after time that every time they go and destroy a house of this nature, they have to clear that, first of all, they shouldn't be doing it against international law, but even with that, they should make sure that they're not going to harm people neighbouring those houses. And they've repeatedly failed, despite documented cases, to make sure they cleared local areas. A pregnant woman was in the house next to the house that they were demolishing. It collapsed on her and she died. And that's the case of Nuhar Shukri al-Mukaddama on the 3rd of March 2003. There was then the case of two young boys who were going, I can't remember the phrase that's used, but they were going to an orchard to steal apples. That was what they were about. And they didn't know the area very well, and they stepped into something called a killing zone. And they were killed by these flechette munitions, which are some of the most disgusting munitions, and some of the photographs I saw in those cases are the most distressing photographs I've ever seen. Not least because one of them was run over by a tank when they came and retrieved the body. But the tank fired the flechettes at them. These are tiny metal darts that went all over their body. They have been banned by the West Bank commander for use in civilian areas, but the Gaza Strip commander authorised the use of this terrible munition. And these boys were up to no harm whatsoever. They just stepped inside this killing zone and were killed. So that's the case. And that's a case which very rarely we had evidence from a leading Israeli human rights, Physicians for Human Rights activist, who'd been at a hearing at the Knesset where they'd seen, a human rights committee had seen the footage of these children being killed. And what happened is they rolled into that area and retrieved the bodies. And we got the post-mortem reports from the Israeli post-mortems. And there was actually a big controversy because it took about 3 weeks before the bodies were returned to the family for burial. So that's another case we took, because the Gaza Strip line of command in that case includes Doron Almog, and he made the decision to allow those munitions to be used. And finally, we took the case, which is very famous, which is the dropping of a one-ton bomb in a highly populated area of the Gaza Strip, in Gaza City, and the killing of, they were targeting a man called Salah Shahadeh, and they killed many other people, and we represented the family of the people that lived next door, seven of whom were wiped out and several injured in that bombing. So those were the cases that we presented to a judge in London. But the process very quickly was as follows. We presented the file, because we were already presenting the file in any event, to this and many other cases, to the lawyers, to the police officers in the summer of 2005. And that was during the time that a very important trial occurred in this country. Right at the same time, we met them, in fact, at the Old Bailey, because they were there on the case of an Afghan torturer who was being prosecuted and who was convicted of torture, and which is one of the clear and first cases in this country of the use of universal jurisdiction to prosecute someone for a crime committed abroad of torture. So we do have a case in this country that's happened. And when we met those people, we said to them, look, we've got these cases. We don't know when these people are coming. Please treat it seriously. And I don't think they did, because a week or two later, when we learnt of Almog's arrival, they were shocked that they actually had to look at this seriously and consider talking to the Crown Prosecution Service. Because of what happened and the events subsequently, we know that they took it very, very seriously, that they accepted. We had very strong evidence against Doron Almog, specifically in the chain of command in these four cases, and that the strongest case was a house demolitions case, because he went on television after he demolished those houses and explained that it was an act of reprisal for the killing of some Israeli soldiers in a completely unconnected area nearby in the Gaza Strip. These houses had been demolished as a kind of general punishment. And very briefly, I'll tell you then what happened. So we presented the case, they didn't take it seriously, and we went, as we've got a right to do under the provisions that currently exist, to a judge to get an urgent arrest warrant, because the police said that they would remain neutral. They don't have time to think about this case and make an arrest, but they won't interfere with us getting an arrest warrant. That was granted, and Doron Almog should have been arrested as he arrived at Heathrow Airport on Sunday the 11th of September 2005. Unfortunately, through a series of leaks, which we now know about, and if I had time, I'd tell you more about how we learnt about all the disgusting things that happened in the background. But the Israeli embassy got to hear about this and sent a message via someone called, the military attaché who had served with Almog in the Gaza Strip. And he arrived at Heathrow. The pilot told Doron Almog, don't leave the plane, the police are waiting for you. And he remained on the plane and was able to take the flight, the same aeroplane, back to Israel and escape justice in the UK. It's our intention to carry on working on these cases. We know of people that visit here. We know of people that study here. They're not just from Israel. We're looking at cases involved with torture and war crimes in many other jurisdictions as a result of this case. And in my view, it's only a matter of time before cases of this kind against Israeli suspects and against other suspects visiting here and other European countries will go to court. And a number of cases are ongoing that I'm aware of at the moment. So we should be aware that universal jurisdiction is a very powerful tool for bringing people to justice. It's obviously much harder to bring people to justice when they're from America, Israel, or any other powerful country. But even they now, in my view, despite the political problems in bringing these cases, which we experienced, I think that there really is there's going to come a time when one of these suspects from Israel is actually arrested and prosecuted when they step into a jurisdiction that's actually willing to take them on. And my job, those of lawyers working with me, is to try and make Britain one of those countries. And that's what we'll continue to do.
That was Jewish lawyer Daniel Mashover from IJSN, the newly formed International Jewish Solidarity Network. Now we have some music, and this is Haxel with We're Still Here.
Leaving the game, but we're still here. But we're still here. There's nobody left on Amsol's name. But we're still here. But we're still here. We're carrying on like two pantomime dames. But we're still here. But we're still here. We don't want fortune. We don't want fame. If we were looking for that, why don't we never get fat? All right, axe or a shine. Everybody's sitting up, but we're still here, but we're still here. None of the kids are still up for the cup, but we're still here, we're still here. We don't know what's happened to all the young pups, but we're still here, but we're still here. We don't want fortune, we don't want fame. If we were looking for that, well, everyone would be Axel.
That was Haxel with We're Still Here. Next up, we have another piece of music. This is by a group called Little Angels and a track titled She's a Little Angel. That was Little Angels with She's a Little Angel. Every autumn, Bristol's Arnolfini Arts Centre hosts the Benn Lecture, inaugurated 2 years ago by ex-Bristol MP Tony Benn. This year it was a tour of Britain's only woman Muslim columnist, Yasmin Alibi Brown, who writes for The Independent. Her talk this year was entitled Not One of Us, and she is proud not to be part of the London media inner circle.
Bristol has been a city of my heart. Not only did I meet the man 4 months after the last one ran off, here in this room, then had a drink in the bar, then was proposed to a year later on the suspension bridge, and found out I was pregnant with my child when I was way beyond such things in Bristol. So year on year, this has been the making of my family. So thank you. I'm not even sure that this honour, that I'm worth it, really, because there are so many other people, but that's a typically female thing to say, isn't it? I think I am worth it. I certainly don't think that it should be my role to share with you expertise, because I'm not an expert in anything at all. I became a journalist at 37, so it's never too late, never too late. It was a dream I had really early on, but when you are in an exile in a new country, especially a country in like this one, where old connections and nods and winks and understandings determine who gets what in the media, there just was no way, you know, somebody, an immigrant from Africa, was ever going to get into this club. And although I was lucky and I was determined and things happened and I did get to be a columnist, the first non-white columnist in this country 11 years ago, I'm still not one of them. And I think that's a great strength. It's a great strength. And I want to talk a little bit about how important it is if you want to be a good journalist, and certainly if you want to be a columnist worth the salt, you should never, ever, ever want to be one of them. Because once you are one of them, you lose the edge that you must have, the independence you must have. And also the sight and sounds and sensitivity you must keep alive, which very quickly, and it's happened to me, there have been moments when one secretary of state or another got a little bit too fond of me, or some head of some organization, and I found myself having lunch with them a couple of times, three times, and the next time a scandal broke or something happened, I found it really difficult then to write about them or to write about the organization, because you feel, gosh, they paid for that expensive meal, didn't they? And so we're all susceptible. I'm not saying, you know, but I do think it's really important. I get 800 emails, 800 to 850 emails a week now, which has completely changed the life of a columnist. You know, previously, say 5 years ago to 6 years ago, you'd get letters, maybe by midweek or 2 or 3 days after your column came out, you'd get on a good week 20 or 30 letters. Now you have this flood of emails. What does a columnist do? A columnist has got to read it, I would suggest to you, because that is your only testing point, what your readers think of you. They don't have to love you, and my goodness, a lot of mine don't. They would rather I was dead and well buried. But nevertheless, not to be able to read would be like, you know, not to be able to see in the dark. You have to see what they're saying about you. Gets more and more difficult, though, as the numbers go up and the coarseness of the emails goes up as well. But that is how the world has changed. And these people who email are your friends and your enemies. And sometimes they're both. And one week you'll get an email from the same person saying, Oh, God, aren't you wonderful? I so completely agreed with what you said on abortion. And 3 weeks later, they'll say, who gave you the job? I'm never going to read The Independent ever again. You know, how dare you say this about immigrants? And then they're obviously still reading The Independent because about 10 weeks later, the same person will email again, in love with. So that's the thing that I do love about the new technology. You get, it is like being in a very raucous family, which tests you all the time. So it's very difficult now to be that kind of arrogant columnist that, say, Bernard Levin was once. Bernard Levin was royalty. He was unaccountable to anybody. He did what he did, and nobody dared even say, oh, please, Mr. Levin, I think you are wrong on that. That was the class of columnist of that time. That's gone now. We're really servants of the people. And sometimes I hate it, I have to be honest. It must have been really good to be the aristocracy. But I do think it's a much more interesting and livelier role to play. That's the only test, I would say to you, that matters. How the people you are writing for feel about what you're saying, whether they hate it or love it. They don't ignore it. They don't ignore me. That's very good. And the other test, I guess, is whether your words make any difference. There are times, actually, I have to be honest, when I think, why am I doing this? What am I doing this for? Who's listening? Yeah? Politicians ignore you. They do what they want anyway, but that actually isn't the case. When things work, like, for example, this campaign over the 42 days, it showed the power of the word. We would not have won this campaign, even with the wonderful, and I hope to be one day Prime Minister of our country, Shami Chakrabarti, even with her talents, the campaign would not have been won without the considerable, consistent, relentless wordsmiths who backed the campaign to get rid of the 42 days. Henry Porter was one. And what was interesting was they came from the left and the right. So it wasn't a left-wing issue at all. It wasn't one race or one political camp. It went across the board. And I think it just showed you that the commentators can sometimes have an incredible effect, in my views, from my politics, for the good. They can also have the same impact for the bad, and I'll come to that in a minute. So the lot of a columnist then in the time we're now inhabiting is an interesting one. It's a very exhausting one, sometimes quite a dangerous one, because just as people are very coarse and crude with their words, sometimes they want to kill you. And these days, more and more seem to want to kill you if you're a columnist, so it can be scary. But I think the interesting thing is how alive it is, how this relationship is alive and dangerous and edgy, and which is why I love the job I do. I wrote a collection of my columns was published a few years ago, and I was looking back at the introduction to it. It's called Some of My Best Friends Are, and has pictures of George Bush, Tony Blair, Ariel Sharon, and all my other best friends. And here's what I said in the introduction, which I want to read to you. This book will not please Richard Marriott, I wrote, who wrote to me in the spring of 2005, and I quote, Ms. Brown, you are not representative of mainstream white opinion. You're out on a limb so long it's in danger of collapsing. You like to portray yourself as a fluffy bunny earth mother, whereas in reality you are as full of hate and as extreme as any member of the Ku Klux Klan. You hate and despise your adopted country by returning your undeserved MBE honor, you were just spitting on this country and its people. Mr. Marriott's wife is a black Jamaican, he tells me, and these are her views too. And he joins the thousands who email from around the world, good and bad. And I say that the internet is both a blessing and a curse. Readers have, when they do write in, they make me cry, they make me laugh, they make me scream. Sometimes they make me so frightened that I've had a whole new security system installed in my house. Sometimes they make me shiver through sleepless nights. Sometimes they make me feel very guilty. And because when I wrote this, there were two of us non-white columnists. The other was the wonderful Gary Young, a good friend of mine. Now he's in America. And I said this, that as one of the only two non-white columnists in the national press, there's an awful lot of expectation placed on your shoulders. Of course, it would be like having the only woman. Can you imagine if today we had two women out of the 350 columnists in this country? I mean, how would that feel? So women, black and Asian people and the Arab world and so on have great expectations. The point of being a columnist is they should not have expectations because you're bound to disappoint them, because you're bound to let them down, because you are never going to be, or at least I don't think a good columnist should be, a PR agent for any group, however oppressed, however maligned. I think you still have to be very clear, very honest, very fair, and very unattached to any particular politics. The one issue, and I have to confess to this, I try and do this, it's not always easy. The one issue I cannot detach myself from at all is the plight of asylum seekers. On that, I'm completely and totally biased, and I will always go with them. And I've never, ever been able to write a column against them, partly because I do think they're the most voiceless and helpless people in our country. But I think the interesting thing is that you know how effective you're being by how many people hate you or you've offended. So to date, there's a long list on my website, I was just looking at it. It includes Prince Charles, Camilla, it includes every single imam, I think, that has ever been in the media, certainly the Bakris and Abu Hamzas, Rod Liddell, the various DGs of the BBC, and so on and so on. And certainly, of course, the BNP, that's my badge of honor. The BNP always has me as public enemy number one. I cannot ever be depended on to be pro-Labour, mindlessly anti-racist, pro-feminist, or pro-Islam. And yet all of these are causes very dear to my heart. So the difficult thing is, how do you balance your passion for feminism and detach yourself from that and still say that actually some forms of feminism may have created these problems which were unimagined? And that is, I think, what happens with the challenge of writing columns. There was a very interesting book that came out, I think in 2002, when I thought, it was a few years ago, it would have been a book I would have hated, I would have burnt. It was called The Surrendered Wife. It was by an American woman called Laura Doyle. And she was suggesting that actually feminism of a certain kind had made it impossible for women to be anything other than quarrelsome in the home. They're always picking quarrels. Why didn't we change? Why didn't we just surrender a little bit more to our husband? Then we'd all be happy. And I looked at the book, and most of it was rubbish, and the title was rubbish, but actually, there were some chapters which were really good. Because it said things like, remember what you loved about him. And now think about how many times a day you tell him to change. Huh? Really important thing. So I thought, okay, I'm going to live this for a month. I'm going to be the surrendered wife. I'm not going to nag him about the parking, about why he didn't put the clothes into the dryer. I won't quite become, Mary Tyler Moore, but I will try and be less of a nag, because I realized I'd become a domestic nag. And I wrote about this in a column. And it upsets the sisters so much that there were academic courses, actually, in London on the betrayal by me of the ideals of feminism. And it was really difficult, actually, because that's not what I was saying. I was talking deeply personally about my domestic situation in the home. As it happens, I'm married to a man who does share the housework. But I realized that there was just too much stupid, senseless squabbling. The interesting thing was he hated it. He hated it because he thought I had some plot in my head, that I was trying to drive him mad or whatever. But these are the examples of what I'm talking about, that as a columnist, you constantly have to be alive to possibilities beyond your own politics and your own passions. And it isn't easy. It isn't easy because everybody these days, especially the society in which we live, the loyalty test is the most important test. You have to be loyal to this country, like this man says to me, loyal to the country that accepted me, loyal to my group, loyal to my religion, loyal to my family. And actually, I think loyalty is an overrated quality. It makes us really very stupidly uncritical and unself-critical. So, avoid being one of us, which is the title of a very good book by Hugo Young, which you must try and read, where he talked about Margaret Thatcher's government and how she used to use this phrase, not one of us. Never follow a line which is expected of you, but don't go the other way just to shock and surprise people. There's got to be integrity here. I didn't do this because I thought, I'll just irritate the feminists at Birkbeck University. I wasn't doing that. I was trying to see if I was right or wrong about certain things. So not to deliberately provoke, like in the case of the Danish cartoonists, They did what they did just to provoke. And I think life's difficult enough. Why would you want to do that? But before I go on with the column writing, the independent commentary, I want to kind of go back to the habitat of journalism today. What does it feel like? I've been a journalist for 30 years and a columnist for 11. What is the world of journalism like in the 21st century? In many ways, it is the worst of worlds, I think, because there is so much power in the hands of the media, and they have so much time now to make mischief and damage if they so wish. With the 24-hour media world, you have to fill the time. You can fill some of the time with genuine, interesting, important, essential journalism, much of the time with stupid celeb stuff. But some of the time you fill by mischief-making and doing deeply dishonest and damaging journalism. And it is premeditated harm, and that's why sometimes I do feel incredibly ashamed of the profession that I love. I don't know if you read the story recently, whether it travelled all the way to Bristol, but this was a perfect example of how this kind of media works. Near where I live, just literally a minute away from where I live in West London, there is a family, an Afghani family, living in a house, a big house. She is a lone mother. She has 7 children. And she was a refugee who we've legitimately given rights to, an escapee from Taliban. Some journalist discovered that this house that they had, which in Ealing, where I live, house prices have shot up stupidly, is now worth about £3 million. Because she has a large family, there wasn't council house stock to accommodate such a large family, so they went into the rented sector, which happens all the time everywhere. The Sun journalist, I think the Sun was the first, found out about this and went to them, and they were very innocent people. They did not understand the hounds who were at their door, so they invited them in. They gave them tea. They said, look how lucky we are. Look at this house. And the woman said, it's so big, sometimes I can't even clean it. Look how lucky we are. I don't know how this happened. 8 bedrooms. That was it, wasn't it? They took pictures. There was bang in the Sun. Name of the street, their photographs. their house. Look what's happening. These asylum seekers living in Millionaire's Row, blah, blah, blah. The news of the war. No, then I think the Mail went in the next day. And the News of the World went in on the third day. And by this time, the oldest boy realized that they were being set up. But it was too late. And the News of the World, front page, I saw a Game Boy there. I saw this television there. By the fourth day, these people's lives were completely imperiled. Their neighbors, with whom they'd got on very well, no longer spoke to them. There was excreta through the letterboxes. The children were being threatened. They couldn't go to school. Now, whose fault was this? Okay, you may say it's a legitimate story. If there was anybody to blame, you could blame Ealing Council for not finding accommodation, maybe at a more reasonable price, that wouldn't have created the story. You could blame the private landlord who's charging the most exorbitant rents for this property which is being rented by the council. We never got their photographs. We never got the street where they lived. We never got any of their information. The blame was solely on this vulnerable family, and their lives have more or less been destroyed. They'll never be able to live properly in Ealing again. And that's what I mean, that there is a kind of, that we are living in the worst of worlds in that sense, because the resources to go and hound people is extraordinary. There's all the space and time to fill, and it's relentless. Not that the, as if this wasn't enough, the great Rod Liddle, how many people in this room know Rod Liddle? He was possibly, arguably, in my view, certainly, the most powerful person at the BBC at one point, because he was the editor of the Today programme, and left, he employed Andrew Gilligan, and then with all the Kelly affair and so on, he left, and has since become a tabloid columnist in the Sunday Times. He took up this story, and he probably treated it worse than anybody else on the tabloid. And this is in the Sunday Times, presumably, you know, ABC, AB readers. And so it took off, and then the broadcasters picked it up, and so on, so on. And so I think we're living in a time when the most vulnerable people are afraid of us. I no longer tell people I'm a journalist when I'm with ordinary people, because people are, they're actually withdrawn now because they're so scared of what we can do to their lives. And when I look at what we've done to this poor family in Acton, I can understand why. There's a drift to the right in the media and in the country, indisputably so. And when the drift in the right is picked up by the BBC and then it becomes a way that they report, then I think you can see what I'm saying, that the habitat is very different. A few years ago, Roger Mosey, who was then the head of BBC's head of television, said this in an interview in my newspaper. Quote, "We were very slow on the asylum story. 2 years ago, when it started being raised ahead of the general election, we did not realize the level of popular unease about the issue. I'm disturbed," he said, "that a sort of easy, knee-jerk tendency, a kind of metropolitan ease of saying, oh, it's all got up by the Daily Mail or got up by the BNP or whatever. I don't think this is true. Something we need to be alert to all the time is that we must recognize that we challenge all or test all viewpoints, including the liberal left consensus." The drift to the right. The drift to the right on asylum, and you can see it. After this interview, you saw how asylum began to be covered, or not covered, actually, on the BBC and on other channels. Some of the habitat is the same old, same old. We've seen, we get the same stories, and I can list these very quickly to you. Floods, waves, and tides of immigrants coming in. They're swamping our culture. They're bogus and wily. The feckless underclass, muggers and rapists. We can't get enough of muggers and rapists. Intolerant mullahs, fractious factions. This list was prepared by the Runnymede Trust. Too big for their boots, uppity people who don't know their place, somebody like me. All look the same, all are dangerous, all are now knife crime and gun crime. Spicy, the spicy story, spicy food, spicy women, mystics, all that kind of thing. These things come naturally, the natural footballer, the natural boxer, the natural runner, the natural pop star, poor things. The poor thing story, the victims change, but the poor thing story never changes. The race, bloody race relations industry, the multicultural squander bugs, the problem with multiculturalism is blamed for everything now. Political correctness gone mad, and don't forget the white victims. This is same old, same old. This list was produced in 1985. Tell me if the list has changed. No, it hasn't. Some of the victims have changed. So we are dealing with some of the old. But now, the BNP gets respect. While those on the left are systematically, and I don't mean the extreme left. What's really, really interesting is now, if you want to get on to Question Time, on which I used to be quite a lot, they don't want people on the left on Question Time anymore. I mean, it's just a very simple policy decision. We are irrelevant. The world has changed. Everybody is centre-right. What's the point of moaners and whingers like myself or Tony Benn to be taken seriously at all? So it's very interesting. The national conversation, unlike a lot of European countries, where there is a very solid centre-left or even socialist left, which is part of the national conversation, we've more or less edited them out. And the challenge to you in this room is to give me an example of somebody on the centre-left who regularly appears on our broadcast channels. And look at the columnists too, and you'll see increasingly there's Mark Steele, there's one or two, but actually even The Guardian got rid of Jeremy Hardy and Mark Steele the day they decided they didn't want to be quite the Guardian they used to be. So the habitat is different, and within this habitat, the challenges are multiple. As we know, the two main political parties, there's hardly a wafer to put between them on a lot of issues. And so we have a made-up consensus, an invented consensus, because I know for a fact, and you know for a fact, that there are a huge number of people who feel disenfranchised, unrepresented. A lady just came and gave me a leaflet on refugees and asylum seekers. You wouldn't know if you followed our media that there are such people who do care about what is being done, because they're edited out. And so a false consensus has set in. And within this false consensus, a lot of columnists, I would argue, including some very good friends of mine, have kind of started to belong to that consensus, have entered this consensus, have become one of them. And I think that's one reason why our national conversation is so sterile so much of the time. And I think we really need to think about how we can start to address this. And why then the internet becomes the alternative source? Of course, it's not that the internet is threatening us. It's that we have been so poor at maintaining independence and integrity that people have gone elsewhere. I really do think that. I don't think it's just the excitement of the new that made people turn to the internet. It's because we let them down, and we continue to let them down. And I think this is a very important point. But having said that, I do find that the whole internet and blogging and alternative world out there in the ether brings its own kind of poisonous fumes to communication between the press and the people. We have to watch out for the damage that is being done in a completely different way on the internet, because what is happening out there is a real culture of cynicism, so extreme that people don't believe anything anymore, and probably if allowed to carry on in this way, never will. Everybody's presumed to be lying. Everybody's in on the make. No information source is trusted. And a very important voice in providing a critique of this internet force is Andrew Keen, and you must go look him up on the internet or buy his book, better still. What he's worried about is how today's internet is killing our culture. And I think there is a really important argument. When you create an alternative source of information and opinion, which is almost entirely based, well, it comes from not trusting the press and the media, which I understand. But then itself, it becomes a voice not of only of respectable alternative viewpoints, but becomes nothing but a major conspiracy theory, a gang of conspiracy theorists, or worse, like I said, a club of absolute cynics. And I think because there is no redress, there is no mediation, there will be, I think, not long from now, better, if possible, better legal constraints. It is creating havoc out there. And I think we have to be very careful that because, you know, the kind of disillusionment with traditional commentariat has become so extreme, the reliance, absolute naive reliance on what the internet throws up is creating a very strangely ignorant population which thinks it's very well informed. I think that's a really interesting dilemma we all face. So who do I say is the columnist of columnists for me? I think for me, currently writing, that there are a couple of people who do maintain brilliantly the independence I'm talking about, and one of them would have to be Jonathan Friedland. I think Jonathan Friedland is a columnist of such immense talent and integrity that I'm surprised he hasn't won every award going, but he hasn't because he's not one of them. And that's the interesting thing to me. He has never been one of them. And his position on Iraq, his position on a lot of issues, it remains, you know, his own thought through, well-informed. But the other one, and this is my hero, and he writes for the New Republic, not of my persuasion in the United States. But I'm going to spend 5 minutes before the end, before the question, reading you what I think is the finest column ever written. It's yellow. I keep it in a precious place because it was the perfect column. So bear with me. I won't read it all, but I'll read you why I think it was the perfect column. His name, and I hope it's is Leon Wieseltier. It's almost every week now, he says, that I pity the poor immigrant. In Germany, naturally, about which my expectations are low, and in France, about which my expectations are only slightly higher, since it was there that that uniformity as a condition of citizenship and self-love as a basis for nationalism caused the least 19th and early 20th century anguish. Was I wrong, however, to expect a little more of England, that island of negative liberty, in a sea of ends of history, where the ideal of tolerance received its purest and sharpest formulations, and an intimacy with the other was one of the unwitting humanizing consequences of imperialism? But I read The Spectator, and the scales fell from my eyes. The Spectator is the most intellectually lazy journal of intellectuals in its language, and so it has a certain usefulness. Things are blurted out, prejudices are delivered under the mistaken impression that they are ideas. In recent months, and this is a long time ago, this was probably written in about 1984 or something, it's a long time ago. In recent months, it has published two extraordinary attacks on immigrants. One in the name of democracy by Stephen Spender, the other in the name of nationalism by Charles Moore, who was the editor of The Telegraph, arguing bizarrely against Salman Rushdie that, in quotes, it is mass immigration that has got him into the trouble in which he now finds himself, Stephen Spender wrote, one cannot take it for granted that a global population, hotchpotch of the kind which Mr. Rushdie envisages, would be a world safe not just for him, but for democracy. Democracy is threatened in many countries now by immigration, partly because immigration provokes the most reactionary forces in the countries now receiving immigrants. He carries on, the columnist. Spender has made a career as a witness of the intolerance of his time. Is this what he learned? Let us gloss that last sentence then and look at it. First, democracy is not threatened by strangers. It is threatened by the refusal to accept strangers and to treat them fairly and to the horror of their difference. Second, there are not lynchings because there are blacks. There are not pogroms because there are Jews. And there are not rapes because there are women. Reactionary forces are not reacting at all. They are seizing an opportunity to act on desire. And then he goes on to Moore. But Moore is much worse. Much worse. What follows appeared in one of his columns. And he quotes Charles Moore. You can be British without speaking English or being Christian or being white. But nevertheless, Britain is basically English-speaking, Christian, and white. And if one starts to think that it might become Urdu-speaking and Muslim and brown, one gets frightened and angry. Next door to me live a large family of Muslims from the Indian subcontinent. We are friendly enough to one another, and they have done us various acts of kindness. During the Gulf War, however, I heard their morning prayers coming through the wall, and I felt uneasy. I should have felt alarmed. Such feelings are only natural. Now, this to me is the column of columns, because he has taken on the most powerful, the most romantic heroes of our culture, Stephen Spender, Charles Moore, and written a column that no British columnist has ever written against one of the most powerful magazines in this country. That is what I'm talking about, the need to be free, the need to have integrity, and never, ever to be one of them. It's very hard. I don't think I can do it in the way he has done it. And this remains the column of columns for me. Thank you.
Yasmin Alibi Brown there, who has a column in The Independent, who was speaking at the Arnolfini Arts Centre earlier this year. That's all for this Dialect at Christmas special. The studio engineer was Avilés Chittakuran. I'm Jeff Sparks, and production was by Tony Goslin. Dialect Radio will be back to normal in the new year from the 13th of January, so have a good holiday, God bless and goodbye.